Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is author and podcast host Chuck Morse, joined by Bill Hahn. He is the Vice President of Communications for the John Birch Society. We are going to be discussing primarily the effects of this latest Islamic terror attack in New York City, New Jersey, and Minnesota. And by doing a little background in going back to 9/11 and how that might have impacted our freedoms in this country, and bring it up to the election, of course, which is the main topic of discussion right now. Bill, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Chuck. Always appreciate being on.
Bill, give us a little background with regard to the effects, starting with the September the 11th, 2001 terror attack on New York City and the Pentagon, and how that has affected our state of security and what it's done to our government.
Most certainly, actually, that was something that we covered this week in one of our online videos at jbs.org. We talked about how, even last week, we talked about how 9/11 society now depicts more of a George Orwell novel than anything else. I'm sure we're all familiar with the 1984 novel, where you've got the gentleman that's kind of traveling through the novel. That's, you know, he's actually part of it, where he's rewriting history. You know, he's spied upon by, you know, Big Brother, nonetheless. And it's kind of his own journey through the security state, that where he kind of wakes up, but then he gets pulled back into it at the end. And, you know, I think that's not unlike what many activists are kind of going through, patriots, I guess, in America, where they see that something is wrong, obviously, because, you know, we're attacked. But then the question is why? And when we take a look at the why, we notice that there is a much bigger hand in all of this, as far as where to lay the blame with the U.S. government, than maybe most people realize. And, you know, we talk about how former Congressman Ron Paul had talked about blowback back in the presidential election. I think it was 08 or somewhere around there, where, you know, there was a debate where he was talking about, you know, basically, you know, we should treat countries how we want to be treated. And obviously, you know, that's something that we all learned as the Golden Rule years ago. But, you know, as we pointed out in a video last night, that seems like that the foreign policy of the U.S. government is to do unto others before they do unto you. And, you know, it's just the fact that, you know, as Ron Paul points out, we're over there engaging, you know, these countries, sovereign countries, we should point out, that, you know, we have no business really meddling into. And so, as he pointed out, we're over there meddling in all their business, and yet we're doing that because we think that they're going to be coming over here meddling in our business. And it's kind of a, you know, a full circle thing, where if we're doing all of these items and, you know, attacks and whatnot in their countries, why should we not expect them to come over here? And so when we see that there are additional terrorist attacks on American soil, even after post 9/11, you know, it gives us all pause to think that, you know, how about this 1984? You know, are we seeing the rise of a totalitarian regime, so to speak, with all of the inroads that are being made, you know, with the going against the liberties of the American people? You know, as we pointed out before, you know, we count the ways with the Patriot Act. You know, that as I'm sure we all realize, that was written actually even before 9/11. And when that happened, you know, 6 weeks after 9/11, this thing gets dusted off, added to it, and 300 and some pages later, it's, you know, it's now law. And, you know,
no,
it basically,
you know, I remember the fact that right after the Oklahoma City bombing, the U.S. House had debated whether or not to have anti-terrorism legislation inside the United States for domestic terrorists. One of the chief architects of that was representative at the time, Charles Schumer of New York, and it included much of what would eventually become the USA Patriot Act after 9/11. After 9/11, of course, we had two phenomena, as you touched upon. The first being that it gave us an entree to engage in international intrigue and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. And we've become more embroiled into a perpetual state of war around the world, and doesn't seem to have really stopped the threat of Islamic terrorism. The other phenomena is the increase of the national security state domestically, with even such inconveniences as having to take off your shoes at the airport, but just in general, you know, a kind of an eavesdropping that was brought to light years later by Edward Snowden, and the fact that the NSA has been increasing its ability to listen in on our cell phone conversations and know what we're doing on our computers and whatnot. And this all goes along with this very bizarre phenomenon of welcoming into the country over a million refugees, so-called, from countries that are presently racked by Islamic terrorism. And then we have an FBI director, President Obama's FBI director, Comey, admitting that there is no way that these people can be properly vetted. And we've seen that people who came over after 9/11 have been involved with continuous incidences of mass terror inside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that the one thing that I'd also like to bring up is that the one thing I learned from the 9/11 attack is the nature of jihad. I don't think that's something that was simply invented. I think that the Islamists are involved in a very much like the communists before them and the Nazis before them. They believed in control of the entire planet. You know, this is part of their religious understanding. It's a militant and political understanding that the world has to submit to the scimitar. That they, in fact, the word Islam means to submit, and that they feel commanded to bring about the conquest of the entire planet, either by outright force, which is jihad, or by civilizational jihad, which is the transfer of populations into Europe and the United States and the rest of the world that they view as not yet conquered, the world of war. You know, we might notice that this refugee, massive refugee influx, that they're not going to other Islamic countries, you know, at least with the exception of Jordan. No, they're coming to the West. They're coming to Europe. They're coming to the United States. And this is part of what I've read about this sort of civilizational jihad, the Islamization of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of that?
Well, I'm sure you saw the memes that were going around with Saudi Arabia having all of those tents available for refugees, but yet there were none there.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and so they weren't accepting anything, but yet when you take a look at the refugees themselves, why is it that, you know, we've got this wave of you know, of refugees? You know, here you've got the Obama and Ban Ki-moon out co-chairing their UN summit, which is going on this week, regarding refugees. I mean, that's at the top of their agenda. But yet here you've got two gentlemen that were basically instrumental in making sure that, you know, there was a refugee crisis. Because of the nature of the perpetual war, you know, we look over at these countries where they're coming from, and, you know, again, the Allied forces, American forces, have got large say, I guess. And again, I don't want to you know, point the finger at our military, but it's the fact that it's the leaders that have put these folks in the position of where they're at. And, you know, so again, we're meddling into these countries, we're droning them, they're, you know, we're bombing the heck out of them whenever we can. You know, we've got innocent civilians that are being slaughtered, just to get the folks that matter. And, you know, again, we make the argument that you know, you, as many as you're going to kill, you're going to you know, raise even more because of the killing of those folks. So where is the argument, of course, that we ought to be pulling back and not pouring more, blood, treasure, and everything else into these endless wars. You know, where is the Constitution in all of this?
Well, Bill, the argument that is made by the what we might euphemistically call the Eastern Seaboard liberal establishment, people like the Clintons and George W. Bush, is that if we don't engage in these wars, especially after the horrors of 9/11, then the Islamic jihad is going to metastasize. It's kind of like it's the same argument that was used in World War II. You know, it's the same argument in the sense it was used against the communist entity by Reagan, even though he didn't actually fight a hot war. He stood up to the evil empire, and he surrounded them and cut off economic trade and took other aggressive measures, which led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I guess that, do they have a point at all with regard to how to deal with a metastasizing internationalist movement of Islamism? Or would it be maybe a better policy might be containment?
Well, let's go back to what the purpose of terrorism basically is. I mean, there's basically two purposes. You know, one is changing the body of people actually that are in power, which is, is the government. The other is facilitating a change in the policy or the system of the existing government. And when you take a look at what Osama bin Laden had spoken just after the attacks of 9/11, he comes right out and basically tells you the reason why he went ahead and did all this. And that his quote is, "The battle has moved inside America, I tell you. Freedom and human rights in America are doomed. The U.S. government will lead the American people and the West in general into an unbearable hell and choking life." So, there's really no doubt in his mind about the purpose of, his organization. It was to frighten the American people into standing still while, the government becomes more onerous. And, of course, as we pointed out, in the name of security, clamps down on our basic freedoms that, we all enjoy. But yet, the freedoms that our government...
Well, how do we beat that? I mean, that's a... it's almost like something that could have been ripped out of a Marxist pamphlet in the 19th century. This idea that the bourgeois have to be utterly crushed, and defeated and annihilated. And I mean, Marx used that kind of language in some of his pamphlets that were written in the 1840s. And it's the same idea that the enemy has to be destabilized through either terror or through subversion, and weakened and softened up to the point where they can fall like a piece of ripe fruit. So how do we combat it? I mean, I think that I take bin Laden absolutely his word, as other mullahs and leaders of the Islamic world who say that the United States is the great Satan, Europe is the middle Satan, Israel is the little Satan, and that these nations are crusader nations and they're infidels and that they have to be crushed. How do we deal with this?
Well, as we have seen, especially through what was known over in Britain as Brexit, the fact that there are a number of instances of when government is really good at creating a crisis. And of course, they capitalize on all of that by clamping down on liberties, taking away all sorts of privacies, all in the name of security. But yet, what is their solution for all of this? And it's more additional government. And so it's just a more of a formula, so to speak, Chuck, as far as to, bringing more and more onerous government into play so that, now instead of seeing where we have just the, Constitution that we're dealing with that is supposed to be limiting our government, we're abrogating all of this to, regional government figures. So much along the lines of what the people over in the UK got mad about, all of their legislation was basically stamped in Brussels, and they got so sick of it. And I think that the match on that or the trigger on that was basically all of these refugees running roughshod over their country. And what happened is obviously, as we all know, they stood up and said, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're getting out of this. We want to go back to, what we used to have as far as control over our own country. And, you know, so we go back to, you know, what can we do? Well, we need to realize that, you know, again, we've got this perpetual war out there, you know, where we have to defeat the so-called enemy. But yet, if we can educate ourselves as far as what the limited government under our Constitution is supposed to be, we will not have the problems that the larger government that we have, that we do have, you know, has as far as today's endless wars. And that is a heck of a mouthful.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing up a great and real example when you talk about Brexit, which is a something that I think has shaken the entire world, something that the establishment did not expect. And it was a reassertion of national sovereignty by the English people, who said that we want to stop this insanity of welcoming in refugees who don't like us and who are not contributing to our economy and who are not assimilating into our culture. And because this is wrong and it's not in our best interest, we're going to reassert sovereignty as a progressive value. And that I think that that absolutely, and you bring it up quite accurately, is a good solution to the jihad, that that is the exact solution to the jihad, a reassertion of the political and cultural rights of sovereign nations to decide who comes into their national home and to decide who they're going to ally themselves with, and to do so based upon a principle of self-interest. Now, in the United States, of course, we have the election coming up. I think that Donald Trump is all about Brexit. This is the same dynamic at play.
Well, and we, you know, you happen to see the, you know, President Obama go over there and try to persuade, you know, the Brexit voters to go otherwise, you know, to have them to stay in the EU. And anybody can see that, you know, a President Hillary Clinton would basically be an ongoing presidency of Obama. And, you know, the fact that she certainly wouldn't stand up for sovereignty, you know, with the other countries, and certainly, you know, she wouldn't mind abrogating the responsibilities of our country as well. So I think you bring up a good point that, you know, as far as the two that go head-to-head, Hillary and Trump, that, you know, it seems like Mr. Trump has got the upper hand regarding, you know, obeying sovereignty of at least, you know, where we're going with the Patriot movement anyway. But, you know, as you and I were talking, actually even before the interview, though, too, is you know, a politician's rhetoric doesn't usually match its record. And unfortunately, with Mr. Trump, we just don't know. You know, he hasn't had the record, you know, for us to look at. So what we have is, you know, is past rhetoric, current rhetoric, and, you know, the only record we're going to have is you know, if he gets in. So it's kind of a gamble.
We don't know exactly what would happen if he does get in, but he has opened the box and discussed issues that have never been discussed in
exactly.
recent memory. I can't remember any major politician ever getting into these things, and when they do, they were immediately their reputations were destroyed, and they were dismissed into oblivion. And yet, Trump has prevailed not only as the nominee of a major party, in spite of the fact that hundreds of millions of dollars were spent by the Republicans to stop that, but now he's actually has a shot at being elected president.
And
exactly. Those issues are very much like the Brexit issues. He wants a reassertion of American national sovereignty, his whole slogan, put America first, you know, which is something that should not be controversial. I mean, who else would we put first? But yet it is controversial in this day and age because of this fuzzy internationalist idea of turning America into a province of the world and part of an international ant colony. So, you know, the fact that he is speaking plain old-fashioned American, and, you know, it kind of makes us almost, you know, homesick for America to be American again. I mean, this is, you know, and based upon basic common sense principles of putting our own interests first and our nation's interests first as our representative. And he's talking about consistently about some very specific things. you know, in economic nationalism, this idea of having trade policies that don't entangle us into lopsidedly negative trade deals, which allow foreign corporations to dump the products in America and hurt American labor. And, you know, not in being entangled in these international wars, but putting America's interests first. I mean, he certainly has said that he wants to defeat ISIS, but not in the same way that the internationals do, where we're always out there nation building and creating new, you know, false, you know, occupations. He would go in and do it the old-fashioned way, kick their ass and get out.
Well, I do have to bring up 2 points, and the first is the, you know, is the fact that the John Birch Society doesn't endorse political parties or candidates. But I will tell you that this is the first presidential election in decades that we have actually heard, actually probably the first at all, that we've heard a candidate actually talking about some of our top action projects. And, you know, the fact that, you know, he's talking about, as you point out, you know, Americanism and, you know, trade among countries. I mean, that is just huge. You have seen, you know, Hillary Clinton back TPP when it was popular, and then to not back it when it was popular, to do so. And so usually what you see with the international types is that, you know, they will back it once they get their just rewards, you know, put into it, so to speak. You know, when they have their concerns addressed. And, you know, you just cannot rely on, you know, a globalist politician or, you know, a neoconservative or, you know, a hard left person to basically come forth and want, you know, the sovereignty of this country. Now, that being said, you know, in one of our recent issues of the New American magazine, we did a number of profiles on candidates, and it includes, you know, Hillary and Donald, as well as the folks that are on the Libertarian Party and the Constitution and Green Party. And, you know, we look at the at what we would consider the Green and the Libertarian parties, and it doesn't seem like there's much of a sovereignty, you know, saving situation there either. However, those with the that are familiar with the Constitution Party, I mean, that's, you know, they stick most closely with the Constitution, so obviously, you know, they're interested in American sovereignty.
Right, but they're not going anywhere. I mean, you know, there's going to be one of two people in the White House less than 6 months from now. It's going to either be Trump or Hillary, and that's the choice we have. I mean, that's I think that we have to so we have to get behind one or the other. And also, I think Trump has opened up, and this is, there's always intangible aspects to any election. There's cultural aspects. And he has opened up a cultural aspect that I think could really be very powerful, and that is that he has challenged this tyranny, this totalitarianism of political correctness. And, you know, in the form of, like, micro, you know, right? I mean, you know, micro.
Oh, yeah. If he's done anything,
yeah,
he's
looking
done that.
But they have us under a microscope looking at, like, for a microorganism that might be racist and that kind of thing. And you notice they never do it to anybody that isn't goose-stepping to the left. I mean, it's anyone who is perceived as an enemy is suddenly they take out the microscope and they try to find something. And this has worked for them. It's a huge weapon for them and has been a growing weapon for many decades. And Trump has really taken that on. And he's done it quite openly. I mean, if he accomplishes anything else, it's that. He said, look, we're not going to have political correctness that, you know, prevents us from vetting people coming in the country for whether or not they like America. You know, like this guy that just tried to plant a bomb in New York the other day. You know, he's saying we're not going to do that, even though it sounds good. It's not really in our best interest. And, of course, Hillary is going back to the same playbook. In fact, as she's losing ground, she's retrenching it even more. And that is that Donald Trump and his followers are racist, sexist, homophobes. And they added Islamophobes now and xenophobes. Mm. They've got in other words, we're all mentally ill. That we're haters. And I just think that if we can beat that and people can see through that, then that's going to be a huge victory for our culture, because this is nothing more than totalitarianism at its worst. This is an attempt by the left establishment to literally control not only our thoughts, our actions. It's going to make us crazy. And I think that it has to be rejected. Nobody's racist. The only people that are racist are people like Hillary Clinton, with her white man's burden patronizing attitude, where she views African Americans as children.
Well, and that's an excellent issue too, Chuck, is that, what has, and you know, we have black members that bring up the fact that, hey, what has, and they bring this up to the African American community, and they say, okay, Black Lives Matter, what has voting for, these big government politicians, for the last 40, 50 years done for you? Are you any better now than you were, back when? And when we look at the destruction
of things.
Right.
Yeah.
When we look at the destruction of the American family, it's hand in hand with with all the policies that were put forth in order to create a safety net for these folks. And what good is that? Here we are attacking the building block of society, and it's just not a good thing. And I think you're right from a standpoint of if anything, that Trump has opened up that facade, so to speak, and let in the sunlight of truth regarding it.
Yeah, they've offered minorities two things: abortion and welfare. Their corrupt governments in cities like Detroit and Newark have destroyed black entrepreneurialism. They've destroyed education for young. First of all, they destroyed the black family starting in the 1960s with welfare, paying people to get rid of the male in the family and then paying them extra for each child.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have young men growing up without a father in the house. Then they come in, they destroy education by introducing look, say, reading and other modalities that have scrambled young people's brains, and it particularly affects minorities who, again, have a single-parent family. They've destroyed the black church with their attack on religion in general, and then they've destroyed black entrepreneurialism with their anti-business, anti-capitalist programs. So then the only people left to help black people now are the police. And if Black Lives Matter really cared about black people, they would be protesting the left. Not police.
Exactly.
So
yeah, and it's all in how you look at it too, with regards to the enemy, so to speak. I mean, the left will always demonize the fact of the people that are against their issues, and so when you have an argument that's based off of emotion instead of facts, you've got all these ad hominem arguments, and you're basically focused on, who can we blame? Who can we focus on as the enemy? And, unfortunately, in many of these instances, with Black Lives Matter, I mean, they point to who they consider the establishment, which is, they point at the police. Well, as you and I and your listeners all know, the police aren't the ones that are establishing law. It's their city councils, it's their state legislatures, it's so on and so forth. But yet, where can they do the greatest amount of damage? Is let's go after the police. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Here they are.
While it should be pointed out that not every policeman is great and that there are instances of abuse, nevertheless, these are people who go out every day and risk their lives trying to protect black neighborhoods from terrorists and from criminals and dangerous thugs. So, I think that's a point that needs to be made.
Yes, and I think when we look at the folks, when we look at these protests, you can see that these folks aren't from that neighborhood. Who in their right mind would burn down their own neighborhood, their own businesses, and cause as much property damage as possible in their own neighborhood? I mean, that defies logic. And the folks that do the protesting, I mean, they are bussed in from other locations. Most recently, it was down in Milwaukee, where they had all of those in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where they had all of the protests with Black Lives Matter. And you know, these folks came up from Chicago, and the Milwaukee police chief actually pointed out correctly. He's like, here we've got members of the Revolutionary Communist Party coming up from Chicago and creating all of this trouble in Milwaukee. Well, he hit the nail on the head. And the JBS has been pointing this out for decades, you know, that
yep.
that there
the
is this war
that
on
burned down. Yeah, I mean, it's the same people that burned down American cities in 1965 and 66 with
right.
outside agitators, communist-inspired groups who, you know, really, I mean, it's really actually quite sad that they set back Black progress by a whole generation. You know,
exactly.
You had opportunities where people could have gotten into business and been in control of their own lives and enjoyed the American benefits of freedom. And instead, they have to deal with these people who are using them as cannon fodder in their demented idea of a revolution, about transform mankind into, you know, the one world beehive. And, you know, it's a sad thing. I think that Black people are waking up, though. I think we're
right.
going to see we're going to see Donald Trump get a shockingly large number, not a huge, he's not going to get the majority, but he's going to get a major increase in Black and Hispanic votes, even Muslim votes, I point out. I don't think Muslims want to have, you know, they don't want the terrorists coming in. You know, I get that sense.
Right.
You know, of course, we'll see in a couple of weeks how it goes. I don't know.
Oh, most certainly. You know, and the fact that, you know, the American people are waking up, you know, through his messages and through the messages of, you know, of our members and other, you know, related organizations. Can only point to, you know, to a good, you know, as far as the future goes.
Now, Bill, while we have a few minutes left here, could you please let my listeners know how they can get The New American, how they can find out more about the Bird Society?
Well, certainly, actually, you know, we have a pretty good online presence. They go to jbs.org for the John Birch Society. They can certainly take a look at the organization. It gives them links to all of our affiliates, including The New American. They can also go directly to The New American magazine at thenewamerican.com. And we have a number of options for folks. They can get our weekly e-newsletter at jbs.org. They can get our daily top headlines from thenewamerican.com. And so we can be in constant communication with them, you know, regarding education, because that's exactly what we do. Is we, you know, we basically have an educated electorate out there that we're trying to uphold, and you know, we organize, educate, and activate, you know, grassroots patriots to, you know, achieve less government, more responsibility, and with God's help, a better world. And so we put the appeal out there for, you know, for people of all good moral character and conscience to join with us.
And I particularly like the New American email. I urge people to check that out. You can just simply go online and put New American into your server, and it'll come up, and you can subscribe to it. It gives you a good, solid digest of what's going on in the world, and it's a good source of education. Bill Hahn, I want to thank you again for joining me this afternoon. Bill Hahn is the Vice President of Communications for the John Birch Society. Bill, thanks so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate it.
All right, take care.
All right, thank you,
Chuck. All right, and you're welcome. And I shall return. Actually, I guess coming up tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about what's happened to manhood with Doug Giles, a good book he's got out. And I want to just take a brief minute to mention, of course, my books. They're available at Amazon or Amazon Kindle. Just put my name in the server and they come up. Chuck Morse, like Morse code, M-O-R-S-E. And you shall see a plethora of books that I've written, all available to you, very very moderately priced books. These are, some of them are email, are e-books, others are soft cover and e-books. Now, my latest being Communism Is Not Dead, The Communist Conspiracy in the 21st Century. Anyway, so thanks for listening, everyone. This is Chuck Morse, host of Chuck Morse Speaks. Have a good day, everybody.